Welcome to the Science Podcast for July 13th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, a vaccine recombines in the wild. The Clovis may have had company in early North America, and a look at a big problem in the United States.
You know, an HIV is kind of like the horror movie where this stranger comes to town and knows secrets about everyone and starts revealing them.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Live but attenuated or weakened viruses are widely used in human and veterinary vaccines. One risk of using live vaccines is the remote possibility that they can recombine with other viruses when co-infecting the same host. While this phenomenon had been described in the lab, it was thought to be too rare to happen in the wild. However, according to a report by Joanne Devlin and colleagues, a recent epidemic of a herpes virus in chicken flocks in Australia has been found to be a result of such a recombination. Science's Stuart Wills spoke with Devlin about the implications of this finding.
So we've been investigating the cause of a large number of outbreaks of quite severe respiratory disease in poultry flocks in Australia. And we knew that the disease was due to a virus called infectious laryngotracheitis virus. And this is a herpes virus. But what was interesting is the strains that were causing the disease were new strains that we'd never seen before. So what we did was we sequenced the full genome of these new strains, and we also sequenced the genome of the vaccine strains that were being used at the time. And what we saw was that the new virus strains were actually recombinants from the different vaccine strains, which was something that's never been seen before in the field.
Okay, well, let's dig down into that a little bit. First of all, let's talk a little bit about what first kind of raised questions or raised the alarm that this might be a problem, recombination of vaccine herpes viruses to form these virulent strains.
Okay, so under experimental conditions, we do know that herpes viruses are able to recombine if two viruses infect the same cell at the same time. And in the lab, we've even seen recombination between mild strains generate quite a virulent virus. So we knew that it was possible, at least in theory. However, the chance of it occurring under natural conditions was always thought to be very remote, and that's because of the low likelihood of co-infection of the same cell with two viruses under natural conditions.
And so you wanted to look at whether this was happening in view of the emergence of these virulent strains in the field. How did you set up a study to actually look at this question?
Yeah, so what we did is we looked at the two field strains that were causing most of the disease outbreaks, and we actually call them type 8 and type 9 viruses, and that's just based on a little test to look at their genetic profile, quite a simple test. So what we did is we collected some isolates of these two different strains, and we grew them up in the laboratory, and then we used high-throughput DNA sequencing to determine their entire genome sequence. And at the same time, we sequenced the entire genomes of all the three vaccine strains that were being used in the country at the time, and then we compared the genomes of the new viruses to the genomes of the vaccine strains.
And so what did you find from that? What came out of that analysis?
Yeah, so that was really interesting. What we found was that the genomes of the new field strains, some areas of the genome were identical or almost identical to one of the vaccine strains, but other areas of the field strains, or other areas of the genomes of the field strains, they were identical to a different vaccine strain. And this was based on the location and nature of some different genetic markers that were present in the DNA, and these were either SNPs, which stands for single nucleotide polymorphism, or indels. This is a term used to describe nucleotide insertions or deletions. I guess usefully, herpes viruses, like other DNA viruses, are genetically very stable, so changes to the genetic sequence, like these SNPs and indels, don't arise very frequently by chance or by random mutation during viral replication. And so the patterns of these markers, the SNPs and the indels, in the new recombinant viruses are really easy to trace back to the vaccine strain that gave rise to them. And I guess what we thought was particularly interesting is that we saw two different new recombinant viruses arise in such a short time, which is only about a year. And this, to us, suggests that vaccine recombination may not be such a rare event under these specific conditions.
Well, I guess that sort of leads to the broader question. We have evidence here that we have these different vaccines circulating in the population that can lead to this kind of recombination event. Do we have to worry about this kind of event for other viruses as well?
Yeah, well, I think it's something that we should definitely consider for other herpes viruses against which we use multiple live vaccines in the same population. And this is certainly not uncommon in veterinary medicine. So in veterinary medicine, we use multiple live herpes virus vaccines to prevent disease in species like not only poultry, but also pigs and cattle and other species as well. In a way, though, we have known about recombination in other viruses for a long time. So in viruses such as influenza viruses, for example, which have segmented genomes, we've known for a very long time there's a high risk of reassortment between those individual gene segments from different parent viruses. And in influenza viruses, we manage the risk of reassortment by using inactivated vaccines because they're unable to recombine. So that's not something new. But what we see now, or what this research leads us to reconsider, is that now that we've seen it once in herpes viruses, it may be wise to reconsider this in other types of virus vaccines as well, vaccines that we've thought previously have had a low risk of recombination. This could include some of the unsegmented RNA viruses, and also some of the other DNA viruses as well.
And you were looking at this in poultry. What about in human populations? How do these results kind of reflect on the risk in human vaccines?
So, I mean, human vaccines, we do use live attenuated vaccines in human medicine. But what's different in human medicine is that we don't see the use of multiple live vaccines in the one population. That's much more a feature of veterinary medicine.
So perhaps less of a risk of this kind of event in human vaccines, though not completely eliminated. For herpes virus in particular, and for some of the other similar viruses that you mentioned, what can be done to kind of avoid this sort of outcome?
Yeah, so if we only use one live vaccine in a population at any one time, then this will prevent recombination occurring between vaccine strains. So in Australia, the relevant regulatory body, which is the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, they're already reviewing the labels of the vaccines to change the way that they're used and prevent recombination. So this might be something that we see happen for other viruses and other vaccines in other areas as well.
Joanne Devlin, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Joanne Devlin and colleagues report on recombination of viral vaccines in the wild this week in Science.
There's been a long-standing debate about just who the original settlers of North America were. Dated to about 13,000 years before present, using coprolite and artifact evidence, the Clovis people have traditionally been considered the first to seed the continent. Now, Dennis Jenkins and colleagues have unearthed evidence that an entirely different culture may have preceded or overlapped with the Clovis. Jenkins spoke with Science's Stuart Wills about the efforts his team has made to unravel the mysterious identities of the original North American inhabitants. The conversation begins with the Paisley Caves archaeological site, where much of the debated evidence has been found.
Well, it's in central Oregon, which most people think Oregon as being very wet. But here we are in the northern Great Basin. It's semi-arid, so there are shrubs around the caves, but no trees. So inside the caves, it's extremely dry, and that has provided for excellent preservation of materials that would ordinarily have been eroded away or decomposed. It's a volcanic region, so possible contaminants like limestone or dolomite and such are at a distance, but not right at the caves. The caves are extremely dry, and the site had been investigated by Luther Cressman, a University of Oregon archaeologist, in the 1930s. He had recovered Pleistocene animals, camels, horses, bison, etc., that indicated a very different environment, and he had found obsidian artifacts in and among the bones of those Pleistocene and certainly extinct animals.
So you had a location here that already had sort of some pedigree as a place to find this sort of thing.
It was a very well-known location within the Great Basin, and yet archaeologists had not generally accepted it just at face value. Unfortunately, the artifacts were not well documented, neither were the bones, and consequently, people would give it a nod and say, well, this is a possible location, but we need further confirmation.
And so your paper was kind of about, partly about getting that confirmation.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the Clovis. You know, there has been this long-standing debate over whether the Clovis people, you know, kind of, if you will, seeded North American indigenous cultures, or whether maybe there were other cultures involved. Let's talk first about the Clovis. Who were they, and can you tell me something about the technology that identifies them?
Well, Clovis is named after the town of Clovis in New Mexico, where they first found this very distinctive projectile point or spearhead that has a flake scar that runs right up the middle of the spear point. It's called a flute flake, and whenever you see that, it tells you the approximate age, right around 13,000 years, for that particular kind of a spear point. The one thing that is so distinctive about Clovis is that it has been found with mammoth, mastodon, and other Pleistocene animals like camels and horses and such. So we have no other recognized assemblage at this stage that has been documented for. So that really makes Clovis stand out.
And in this cave, or in these caves, I guess the striking thing was you found artifacts from a very different technology, this so-called Western stem tradition. What can you tell me about that?
Well, they are a dart point, projectile point, that is the horizon marker, if you will. Is relatively narrow compared to Clovis Point. It's thicker. The flaking technology is very different. Western stem is frequently found in caves. Clovis is not. We have Western stem found around what looked to be ancient shallow marshes. So there are some distinctives here between the two technologies.
But I guess the core of the issue is the date of these artifacts, and
yes.
You were going in essentially trying to establish the reliability of dating in this cave to try and attach some dates to those artifacts. That seems like quite a tricky thing to do. I mean, you mentioned things like rodent digging and things like that that can mess up the stratigraphy. Can you talk a little bit about how you establish the reliability of that sort of section?
We brought Thomas Stafford from Colorado to Oregon in the summer of 2009. He returned multiple times each year after that and took hundreds of samples himself. He's a geologist and a chemist. So he took his own samples at close interval from just below Mount Mazama ash, which is a tephra or volcanic ash that gives us a good horizon marker right at about 6,800 radiocarbon years. So from there on to the bottom of the caves, he took these close interval samples, and they are just nicely stratified with the younger dates at the top and the older dates at the bottom. Now, what that has done is to establish the fact that we don't have deposits that are all churned up. In other words, things that are youngest are where they should be, mm-hmm. Things that are oldest at the bottom. Oh, and another thing that we did was he would cleanse the samples with distilled water and then take the extraneous carbon that might have attached itself to the item, either whether it's a coprolite or a twig or something, and he would then freeze-dry that and radiocarbon date the extraneous carbon as well so that we would know whether it was younger or older than, say, the twig that we were dating. And that would tell us whether water was moving down through younger deposits above the item and contaminating it, or whether or not that item had been deposited in an older environment. And what we found was generally any extraneous carbons were older than the specimen, as you would predict if it had not been contaminated by leaching of water through the deposits.
And what did the dates that you got from the cave tell you, you know, in particular about the Western stem tradition artifacts relative to the Clovis artifacts?
The radiocarbon dates we've got have answered the question, are Western stemmed points as old as Clovis? That has been debated since the 1970s, certainly, And people have proposed that we have established that fact beyond question.
So, you know, you mentioned actually in talking about the stratigraphy, you mentioned the use of the coprolites in helping to kind of calibrate the stratigraphic dates. But I gather you also got some genetic information from some of these coprolites. Is there any chance of using that to figure out who these other people were who left these artifacts?
Certainly, it helps us to build a genetic database, if you will, about these people who were first colonizing the Western Hemisphere. The problem is that at this stage, we do not have DNA for Clovis Age human beings. So what you have to do is be able to compare to other ancient human beings, and North America in particular, we do not have any reference points that far back. Most people, when they're talking about genetics, are talking about modern populations.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, at the Paisley Caves, a very unique situation where we actually have ancient DNA from human beings going back 12,000 radiocarbon years.
Hmm. So we'd have to keep our fingers crossed for...
Yes, absolutely, that in the future we will be able to extract DNA with new techniques probably and be able to compare it.
Well, pulling all of this together, what does this work tell us about this whole Clovis debate that's new, and where do you see this work going next?
Well, it certainly reinforces or substantiates, if you will, the concept that there were multiple cultural influences here during the Pleistocene. And so the first colonization is still foggy, if you will, as we look back towards Siberia. We don't know that much about it, but certainly the concept that Clovis is absolutely the end at 11,000 radiocarbon years ago, I think is in serious question, and this brings into focus the concept that other people, or perhaps even multiple waves of people bringing other technologies, were certainly involved in the first colonization.
Dennis Jenkins, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dennis Jenkins and colleagues write about investigating the first humans to settle North America this week.
Want more science in your life? Check us out on Facebook and Twitter at Science Magazine, where you can read highlights, join discussions, or take your best shot at our weekly quiz.
If you thought HIV was on its way out in the United States, think again. According to the United Nations, 0.6% of U.S. adults are infected with HIV. This might sound insignificant, but with its large population, the U.S. ranks just 7th in the world for total number of infected adults, and an estimated 50,000 new infections are reported each year. As part of a special issue this week, Science contributing correspondent John Cohen spoke with me about why HIV is so difficult to treat and prevent in this country.
One thing that's become really clear in the United States over the past decade or so is that there are many different epidemics here. And the way to approach prevention and have success is to target the populations that are most at risk. Those differ greatly from place to place. And we also now know that treatment itself makes people less infectious. So treatment is prevention. And there's a huge effort in the United States to improve the use of the existing tools we have that work.
And so you're referring to antiretroviral drugs, that they work to not only treat those with HIV, but also they prevent it from being spread.
Yeah, and the big picture right now in the United States is that about 80% of people who are infected know their status, but only about 28% of all the infected people have fully suppressed virus. So there's something really wrong there. And that's a lot of what we focus on in this package is how do you improve the situation so that more people are fully suppressed and you get the full benefit to the individual and to the society of the drugs?
Exactly. If our prevention and treatment campaigns are so good on one end, why is HIV such a big problem in the U.S.? I mean, I suppose not knowing that you're HIV positive is part of it. What other factors play a role there?
Well, researchers refer to this as the treatment cascade. And so there are several steps along the way that get in the way of people fully suppressing their virus. So after you're diagnosed, do you link to care? After you've linked to care, do you stay in care? After you're in care and you're starting on antiretrovirals, do you stay on the medication? Each of those steps requires specific interventions to help people. And a lot of HIV-infected people have very serious problems and issues in their lives that make it difficult for them to meet all of those steps in the cascade. There are a lot of people who are very poor who are infected. There's a lot of drug use that's linked to infected populations. There are mental illnesses that are linked. All of those things complicate the ability to get people into care and to keep them in care and taking medication.
And being diagnosed with HIV is incredibly stigmatizing.
It can be. It differs from place to place. And that's another thing that I think is remarkable. Is for some people who live in big cities, they're extremely open about their infection status. If they're on medication and doing well, it's not even the biggest problem in their lives. So in some places, stigma just isn't a big factor. But in other places I visited, small rural towns in the South for young gay men, it's a huge issue. And stigma and discrimination mean that somebody maybe doesn't want to go to the pharmacy in their town to get their medication and has to drive 100 miles away. Mm-hmm. Or it means they really don't want to walk into a clinic that everyone knows is the AIDS clinic. And those things can really complicate the goal of getting people on treatment and keeping them on treatment.
And as you said, this is not just one epidemic in the U.S. It infects a whole lot of different populations and different demographics. So what populations have the highest rate of infection in the U.S.? Who's most at risk?
Today, the biggest burden is in the Deep South. It's in young black gay men. And there are also really high rates of new infection in young black women who are getting infected through heterosexual sex. Injecting drug use remains a big driver in some places, but other places like New York City have had great success stopping the spread in injecting drug users by promoting things as simple as needle exchange to get people clean needles. Then there is a whole sexual network dynamic that occurs in black communities because of the number of black men being incarcerated. And the estimates are that 1 in 3 black men will spend time behind bars during his lifetime, which completely disrupts sexual networks. So men go into prison, women find new partners, and that fuels the epidemic. Then in other places, you also have very high rates of other sexually transmitted diseases like chlamydia or syphilis that ease the spread of HIV. So each location has a different set of variables. In the West Coast, young gay men in particular, and middle-aged gay men, methamphetamine has become very popular, which leads people to take extreme risks that, again, make them more vulnerable to the virus.
Right. And I think what is really interesting about this package of articles that we have this week is that you delve into a lot of detail in some of the major cities across the U.S. So you've mentioned meth in certain parts of California. What are some other challenges that plague these urban epicenters of HIV across the U.S.?
Homelessness is a huge challenge. And people often don't think about housing as a healthcare factor, but it's huge. If you don't have a place to live, your first priority isn't necessarily taking care of your HIV disease. And in many of the urban places I visited, and some of the rural too, housing was a number one issue for people. And so clinics are now reaching out with outreach workers to help people find places to live and find stable housing.
And what I found interesting was that HIV is even a problem across the U.S.-Mexican border between even the cities of San Diego and Tijuana. What are the drivers of that?
The border is much more porous than people would like to believe. People move back and forth between California and Mexico and other bordering states with Mexico with much greater ease than you might imagine. And there's a lot of heroin in Tijuana. And most of the men I spoke with had lived a portion of their lives, if not most of their lives, in the United States and were deported because of drug-related crimes. And they get back across the border illegally or legally. So the virus doesn't see the border guard standing there with the guns. Mm-hmm. It just moves.
And then earlier you mentioned that there was a needle-sharing program in New York that worked well for just this sort of problem. What are some other success stories from these cities?
Well, there are many needle-sharing programs in New York that have addressed the problem there. Other programs that have been very successful, San Francisco has had a very aggressive program to deal with its HIV epidemic. And since it had one of the earliest epidemics, it's had a lot more experience. San Francisco is sort of a model, too, in the way that it has linked the city's Department of Health with academia. The University of California at San Francisco's there. San Francisco General Hospital is operated by the university. So there's all this overlapping interest in solving the problem. I saw the same thing in Birmingham, Alabama, of all places, but it's got a very well-run, well-respected clinic that's linked to the university, that's linked to the community. And it's efforts like that where they go to the next level to address the problems, and they create an environment that is very different from what we often think of as hospitals. It's more family-oriented, and people are much more involved with everyone's lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, in just a few weeks, in Washington, D.C., the International AIDS Conference is going to be hosted by the U.S., which is the first time that it's been held in this country in over 20 years. So what precipitated this newfound ownership of the problem in this country?
Well, the international community turned against the United States a few decades ago because of an HIV immigration ban, and Congress had instituted the ban thinking that it would somehow protect our country from the virus. It was scientifically an absurd idea. And Barack Obama in 2010 led to the lifting of that ban, and the International AIDS Society, which organizes the meeting, decided that it was high time to bring it back home to the United States where it first started. So that's what led to the change. It's been ironic because the United States has been a global leader in so many ways in addressing the epidemic, and the fact that we couldn't hold the conference here, it was ridiculous. The conference belongs here. It doesn't mean it should be here every year. I'm not suggesting that at all. I think it's terrific that it moves around the world. But the fact that we were barred from holding it here was pretty ridiculous.
Right. Well, it's great that it's being held here now. What do researchers hope will come out of it?
Well, one of the things that's interesting at this point in time is how poor countries and wealthy countries are really facing similar issues. All these things we've been talking about, they're called structural issues. They're the same issues people are facing in South Africa, people are facing in Thailand, and people are facing in California. So you're seeing a merger of interests like never before. You know, and HIV is kind of like the horror movie where this stranger comes to town and knows secrets about everyone and starts revealing them. The virus finds all the vulnerabilities in societies and exposes them, and it does that everywhere it goes. And so I think the world now is collectively seeing that we're all facing the same problems, more or less, in trying to get people diagnosed, on treatment, staying in care, and getting their viral loads fully suppressed.
John Cohen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
John Cohen writes about the many faces of HIV as part of a special issue on HIV and AIDS in America. To read his Tales of 10 Cities, view a photo slideshow from his travels to HIV-prevalent areas in the U.S., and to read related articles from Science and Science Careers, visit the special issue page at www.sciencemag.org/special/HIV2012.
Finally today, we have David Grimm, online news editor of Science. He's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, Dave, so first up, we have a story about what big brains get you.
Right. Well, creatures with big brains are somewhat considered more intelligent by scientists, or at least more cognitively complex. But all this has sort of been a correlation. And what these researchers did, this is a group of researchers from Sweden, was they looked at guppies. And what they basically did was they bred them to have smaller or larger brains. They were actually able to achieve about a 10% disparity in brain size. So some fish that had relatively large brains for guppies and some guppies that had relatively small brains. And then they taught the fish to count.
Okay. So obviously the big brain ones were good at counting?
Right. And the big brain ones were better at counting. The researchers basically showed them cards that had either two or four symbols on it, and the symbols were associated with food. And a large brain fish seemed to get it, suggesting that they had a rudimentary counting ability where the smaller brain fish didn't have that. So this is the first
evidence researchers had that actually, yes, making brains bigger actually seems to make a creature smarter.
Wow. So what does that mean for all the other animals out there?
Well, it could mean that big brains do indeed make us smart. But the researchers also saw that big brains tend to come with a cost. These fish that had bigger brains tended to give birth to less offspring. They also tended to have smaller guts, which is a correlation that's been seen in humans and other animals with large brains as well. And the thinking is that perhaps, you know, these big brains are really energetically costly. They take a lot of sort of energy from the body. And if you're going to spend that much energy on one organ, you're going to have to devote less energy to other organs, maybe even the reproductive organs, maybe the gut. Another hypothesis with the gut is that if we have bigger brains and we're smarter, we may be able to be a bit more choosy about our food choices. We may be able to eat smarter foods, and we don't need these large guts to sort out all the different maybe sort of non-selective foods that creatures with not as big brains are selecting for. This is all sort of in the realm of mystery right now. But the important thing the study is really showing is that this is no longer just a correlation. By actually changing brain size, researchers are actually able to show a causative effect between the size of the brain and some of these other factors.
Well, I can't wait to see what they do in other animals. Next up, we have a study on body language in squirrels.
And this study comes with a very cool video, which I encourage everybody to check out on the site. It's a video of a California ground squirrel approaching its burrow, which is this hole in the ground. And he gets really close to the burrow, and out pops a snake. And the squirrel does this really unusual thing where the squirrel starts really shaking its tail really hard back and forth. Almost if you've got a cat and you've sort of seen your cat sort of get agitated at something, the tail sort of whips back and forth. That's sort of what this squirrel is doing. And researchers sort of thought the squirrels were doing this maybe to scare off snakes. They weren't really sure. Another unusual thing researchers have observed is that other squirrels in the vicinity, when they would see another squirrel shake its tail, would also start shaking its tail too, even though they didn't see the snake, and there was sort of a mystery about why they were doing that.
So how do the researchers study this? I mean, they have a video. Were they filming a lot of squirrel activities?
What they did was they trekked out into the California wilderness, and they grabbed a bunch of snakes, anesthetized them, and sort of tracking devices in them. And then they followed them around with these modified security cameras. They had the tracking devices, so they sort of knew where the snakes were going to go. So they still had to sift through hours and hours of footage to find videos like the one on the site. But one of the first things they noticed is what you see in the video, that the squirrels actually do seem to be thrashing their tails in response to the snakes. And not only that, but it does seem to scare the snakes off. These can be very deadly for squirrels. There's actually part of the video where a snake actually jumps out of the hole and does bite a squirrel. And what the snakes do is they bite the squirrel, then let go, and the squirrel wanders off and dies.
Oh.
And then the snake goes and eats it. What happened with one of these squirrels, because the squirrel started swishing its tail, the snake kind of freaks out and goes back into its hole. So that was sort of the first thing that the researchers discovered, was that, yes, this shaking behavior actually does seem to have a positive effect for the squirrels. But what was even more interesting that they noticed was that squirrels in the vicinity were shaking their tails, like I said earlier, even when they didn't see the snake. And there was sort of a mystery about why that was happening. One idea was that squirrels just do this at random, that there's really not a whole lot of thinking. It's what researchers call kind of like an artificial signal. They're not really clued into any sort of alarm call. They're just sort of shaking their tails. But that's not what the researchers saw. They saw that they were really shaking their tails in response to seeing that initial squirrel shaking its tail when it saw the snake, which suggests that this shaking the tail is not only a way for a squirrel to avoid being bitten, it's what researchers call an honest signal. It's a warning signal that other squirrels pick up on, and they say, oh, wow, you know, my buddy is shaking his tail. He must see a snake. I'm going to start shaking my tail. And what the researcher saw is when a snake sees a bunch of other squirrels shaking their tails as well, he sort of hightails it out of the area. So it's a very effective strategy, not only for the squirrel itself, but for the entire population.
So this is kind of a novel study because they got a really up-close look at predator-prey behavior.
Right. This is really hard stuff to study. And if you do try to study it, you ended up just hoping you get lucky. And what's kind of cool about the study is these researchers were a lot more proactive. They actually caught the snakes, tagged them, and were able to sort of follow them around. I mean, they still had to do a lot of work to catch these sort of interactions in the act. But researchers say, you know, this is sort of a good methodology going forward to sort of observing other predator-prey relationships in the wild.
Yeah, I hope they make an internet squirrel cam for us. Okay, David, last up we have a story on inbreeding depression in plants.
Right. Inbreeding depression is if you've ever heard the rule, you know, you shouldn't marry your cousin or shouldn't have relations with close relatives. The reason is because people who are very closely related who tend to get together tend to have offspring that have a lot of problems, mental illness, infertility, really rare genetic diseases cropping up. And the reason is because if you have two people that are very highly related mm-hmm. that mate, they tend to harbor the same very rare genes. And so all of a sudden you've got genes that are very rare becoming much more prominent because they sort of combine in two people and they get expressed in the offspring. And that's what inbreeding depression is. And pretty much forever, as long as scientists have really been studying this, they've really just chalked it up to these rare genetic mutations. Mm-hmm. But this new study in plants suggests that there may be something else going on as well.
So how do they observe inbreeding depression in plants?
Well, they looked at a plant called the Scabiosa columbaria plant. And this is a plant that is native to Europe and Asia. It has dark green leaves topped with small, delicate purple flowers. You can see a picture of it on the site. They're actually very pretty plants. And what's interesting about these plants is these plants also suffer from inbreeding depression. When the researchers mated very closely related plants together, they tended to be a lot more susceptible to drought and poor soil. They tended to be killed a lot more easily by these environmental conditions mm-hmm. than plants that were not inbred. And at first, the researchers said, well, you know, it's probably the same thing that happens in people. These plants probably have these pretty rare genes. And when we breed close relatives, these rare bad genes or bad mutations are sort of coming to the fore and causing the offspring to be a lot more sickly than they would be otherwise.
So they thought the same thing was going on, but they found out that it was actually not just special deleterious genes.
Right, exactly. And the reason they began to suspect that is because it's known that environmental conditions like drought and poor nutrition can cause what are called epigenetic changes. And these are changes not in the genes themselves when we think of sort of as a standard typical mutation, but actually chemical groups that get added or subtracted from DNA, and they can actually cause genes to be turned on or turned off. And lo and behold, when the researchers looked at these plants that were really highly inbred, they noticed that they had a lot more of these chemical groups, they're actually called methyl groups, on their genomes than plants that were not inbred. So they were all of a sudden seeing this correlation between these epigenetic changes and problems that are associated with inbreeding.
So a lot more genes were covered in these markings. What does that mean for the plant?
Well, what it means is that the plant probably has a lot more genes being turned on and off than other plants are. And somehow, and the researchers still don't know how, but turning the genes on and off may be sort of contributing to some of the problems with inbreeding. And in fact, when the researchers treated the plants with a chemical that removes these methyl groups, the plants actually did a lot better. So there really does seem to be a pretty significant effect
wow.
of these epigenetic changes in causing these problems that are associated with inbreeding.
So they could rescue these plants from the effects of inbreeding?
They could, yes.
So, okay, let's take it the next step. What can this do for the royalty?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, they haven't even shown that this would actually even work in the wild. I mean, there's a lot of problems right now. Conservation biologists are really concerned about a lot of plants being impacted by climate change, by human encroachment. It's causing potentially a lot more inbreeding than would happen otherwise, mm-hmm. which is causing these plants to be a lot more susceptible. So one idea is, well, let's just treat them with this chemical and maybe we can reverse the effects of inbreeding. That really hasn't been done yet, but it's an idea. If that worked, I mean, it's still a pretty big chasm between plants and people.
Right.
So there's no guarantee that, first of all, even if these epigenetic changes are actually happening in people as well, mm-hmm. and if they are, whether we could just sort of give people a drug and that would reverse these changes. But it's really an intriguing first step towards something like that.
Definitely. What else is on the site this week, David?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about cornstarch and water. And if you mix them together and walk over them, you don't sink like you should. You're able to form a solid. This has been a very mysterious phenomenon that's puzzled physicists for a long time. And now researchers say they have a new explanation for what's really going on there. Also, a story about a gene that may confer some protection against Alzheimer's disease. We've got a story about some global policy efforts to save coral. Also a story about how a new transport law in the U.S. may be having a negative impact on archaeology studies here. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about life after the Higgs boson. Now that we've discovered the Higgs boson, what's next for particle physics? And next week's Science Live is about sports-related head injuries. What is neuroscience telling us about what happens to people when they get hit pretty hard when they're playing sports? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, David. David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the July 13th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.